Good morning. May it please the court.
You may proceed.
As this court foreshadowed in Batson 1, we're back. The substantive issue here, as the court knows, is whether the legislature properly summarized a proposed amendment to the Missouri Constitution, or whether the summary's failure to include major components of the amendment resulted in an election irregularity. Now, challengers, which included Representative Stacey Newman and Dotson 1, have filed four briefs now in this case. Respondents have filed six. And so I think the substantive issues of whether the summary statement reflects the underlying amendment have been about as briefed as they can be, to be straightforward. I would, if it pleases the court, focus for a moment on the procedural issues that have been raised in this case in particular. Everyone agrees that rather than putting the entire constitutional amendment before the voters to be voted on, what the voters saw in this case was a purported summary of the constitutional amendment written by the legislature. I think it is undisputed that no other branch of government reviewed that summary, nor has commented on it. In this situation, the governor has no opportunity. There's no presentment clause with a summary statement.
Now, when I go to, if I go to the election to vote, they have it on the wall somewhere. What about the absentee voters? Do they get the full language of the proposal?
My understanding, it is not sent with the absentee ballot. In fairness, Your Honor, it is published in the newspaper. The full amount is published in the newspaper. But you're right. If a voter wants to understand what the language is, they have to go find it in the election place, or they have to find it through other means. It is not reprinted on the ballot. And I think that's one of the important reasons that the citizens...
It's on websites. So if you're in Afghanistan or something, a soldier, and you want to vote in Missouri, you can pick it up on some website, probably.
Right. The Secretary of State does publish the full text on the website, so certainly. One could go to the website. One could do research in the dictionary on what the terms mean. There are lots of things that one could do. But the fact that the voters see that summary is why it's so important that the voters and the citizens of the state have some opportunity to have this summary statement reviewed. And this case is a great example. In Dotson 1, the state argued that my clients were simply too late, even though it's undisputed that my clients sued on the first day they could possibly sue, on the first day they had injury. This court agreed that they were too late, and we certainly accept that. This court, as I read the opinion, recognized that that's not just, and that it is not consistent with the overall framework that allows review. And this court said in Dotson 1 that we had the opportunity to file an election contest for review. And so, at a high level, if this court gets to the substantive issue and decides that our position is wrong, so be it. We understand that completely. But it is unfair. It violates the fundamental concept of open courts and the fundamental concept of checks and balances to deny my clients the opportunity to ever have this summary statement reviewed, which is exactly what the state has proposed.
Do you believe you need to file a ballot challenge prior to the election in order to preserve that right, or are they separate rights?
Well, I think that might be a question for the next case, right? My particular clients did file, of course, the challenge before the election. I have struggled with this issue, but when I go back and read the case law, I believe it is clear that an election contest has always been meant to encompass review of ballot language.
And can you address whether ballot language is included in irregularities?
Yes, I think ballot language is included in irregularities. Essentially, what we have here is a subset of the wrong ballot. There are many cases throughout the country where the wrong ballot is given to voters, where there's somebody from a different district, for example, on the ballot, or a candidate was simply omitted from a ballot that was printed. There's a famous Ohio case where the tax rate was listed incorrectly on the ballot. It was really going up $4.50, and they said 45 cents. I mean, these things happen in the process. And so if you have a ballot in front of a voter that does not fairly summarize, it begs the question, of course, a fair summary, But if you have a ballot that is not fairly summarized, you essentially have the wrong ballot. And I think that the irregularity cases talk about that throughout. I sent to the clerk of the court yesterday a decision that we had not mentioned in our brief because it is not directly on point. But it provides a little bit of history of election contests. This was Judge Robertson's opinion in Beatty versus Metropolitan Sewer District in 1985. And what happened in Beatty is they sued the wrong people. It was an election contest, but they forgot to sue the election authority. They sued the Metropolitan Sewer District. And so in that opinion, the court had to talk about what is an election contest, 85. And in that opinion, in what is definitely dicta, Judge Robertson wrote, the wording of the proposition on the ballot and the propriety of the notice of the election provided are issues cognizable only in an election contest. Now, when I read that, frankly, it was kind of news to me because I had always assumed that with the statutory challenge, which Your Honor's asking about, that that's your remedy. You go do the pre-election challenge and that is your remedy. Of course, again, my clients did that in this case. But when this court said in Dotson 1, well, you have an election contest available, I went back and looked at this, and I think the case law supports that concept. This is not new, that it is an irregularity to give someone a ballot that has a summary that's simply improper. And it calls into question, the big issue with irregularities, right, is does it really call into question the integrity of the process? That's why, you know, and we look at some cases, Rizzo being an example, where this court has said, well, you know, if we've got one person who maybe had some trouble at the ballot box, that doesn't rise to the level where we're going to overturn an election. Well, this is kind of fundamental. And most of the irregularity cases where elections are overturned have to do with these fundamental, you got the wrong ballot, you had some systemic breakdown in the structure of the system. I wanted to also commend the Beatty case to this court for this issue of jurisdiction. Frankly, I think the jurisdictional issue is a bit of a side issue because if this court doesn't have jurisdiction, it should remand to the Cole County Circuit Court, which would then enter a decision, and we'd be back for a third time, I suppose.
Isn't there a case pending in Cole County also?
There is. There is. And Judge Green is, I don't know that he granted a stay, but he's essentially sat on that case, for want of a better term, but he has scheduled a status conference. So there is a case there. In the Beatty case, Judge Robertson reviews the history of election contests and election challenges, and I had not really gone back and done that previously, but he talks about how there actually was a point in the history of the state when the courts reviewed election contests under an equitable theory and a declaratory judgment theory. Most of our case law, at least since I've been practicing law, says election contests are statutory creatures, and I've never quite understood why that is. The Beatty case talks about that history. And that the courts did at one point assume jurisdiction over election contests under equitable considerations. When you look at history, you'll also see that the Missouri Constitution on election contests has consistently expanded the legislature's authority to set election contest jurisdiction in the courts. When you go back and look at early constitutions, contests for the election of governor were in the General Assembly. And then contests for the election of other state officers and superintendents of schools, who would have thought, were in the courts, and that was it. And there wasn't any discussion of any other types of contests. And then in 1945 or 1920, it's frankly hard for me to tell, this third provision was added, which is in the briefs, that refers to the various classes of election contests. So that now when you read the Constitution, you have contests for governor, you have contests for other offices, and then you have this sort of catch-all provision of all contests, which is the provision that we rely on.
And the opposing counsel said that just applies to the officers that are mentioned in the first part of that.
And that's my point. I think when you read the history, it's pretty clear that it's not meant to apply just to the first part. That used to be the case, that constitutional provision only applied to those specific officers, but this third sentence has been added historically as a catch-all. I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal, if it pleases the court. I thought I started at 12.
Oh, excuse me. Yes, you do. That's fine. Thank you. You do.
Yes, thank you.
Good May it please the Court, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
The issues in this case, which are among many, are whether, that I want to address, are whether a party can challenge a ballot summary post-election even when there's a specific statutory provision that requires that it must be pre-election, and then second, whether the summary language in this case was an election irregularity, disqualifying nearly a million votes. I think it's worth identifying a few key facts before, particularly procedural facts, before I get into the discussion of those two items, and that is, it is true, the plaintiffs in this case, or plaintiffs in the prior Dotson case, filed their lawsuit on the very day that it was certified by the Secretary of State. And the reason it became moot was not because of anything the state did, not because of anything that the defendants in that case did, but merely because the governor had put it on the ballot for the August primary.
But the law permits that.
Yes, absolutely.
But doesn't allow time for it to review if that's done.
Well, no, it didn't allow time for it to be reviewed, and that is, it was filed on June 13th, and it didn't, it was, the ballots were not going to be sent out until June 24th. So there was time.
And do you think that's adequate time for trial court review and appellate review and revisions to be made?
It could be, yes, absolutely. And to that, I would say,
What else could the contestants have done? I understand you say we didn't do anything wrong to run the time clock out. That might not always be the case, but what else could they have done to get timely review of the claim they make here today?
I think they could have expedited it with the court, which they tried to do. But what wasn't in the record was in the record, but wasn't discussed in the prior case, and that is, at the same time, another party came in and filed a lawsuit. That got consolidated. The plaintiffs filed an amended petition 10 days later, or approximately 10 days later, in that underlying action. I mean, they were certainly moving it forward, but they could have moved it forward more quickly. And I mean, that's,
do
that's
they have
procedural
control, do they have control over when the judges decide to cite
no,
their cases?
They don't have, so, nope.
Well, how could they move it forward?
And yeah. There's no indication in this case there is collusion to prevent review.
No.
But there could be in future cases.
It's possible.
If the court would find that the setting of an issue on the August ballot precludes review because of that short time frame, there could be collusion that would prevent review of ballot language.
Certainly, and that could happen in a lot of circumstances. I mean, where are there deadlines? And I think the thing to understand is that sometimes there are no remedies available, or the remedy is very short. And in this case, it was a very short remedy.
I think the legislature is considering moving the time for printing earlier, two more weeks.
To make it. That may be. And I don't know how
and
that
And then there would be no time to have ballot challenges, ballot summary challenges, and yet clearly the intent of the law is that there be an ability to have that reviewed.
Well, yes, and to that point, I'd like to sort of juxtapose the historical development of this whole deal with the current status. And the ballot titles or summary statements were never a part of constitutional proposals by the General Assembly originally. It wasn't until initiative petitions and referendums were added that summary statements in the early 1900s were added. And with that provision, there was a remedy provided. And it's a narrow remedy itself. I mean, we can all admit that 10 days to challenge something is short and extraordinary, right? That's the remedy that the legislature provided for a challenge to the ballot summary language and under 116.190. And it has always existed that way. If you look at the historical development of election contests versus pre-election challenges, that has always been the case. Going back to the 1900s, going through every iteration after that, the challenge to summary language has always been pre-election, and it is always required that it must be 10 days after being certified.
But so, what if the timing is set up, and what if we posited a different hypothetical where everybody agreed that the summary, for whatever reasons, was inaccurate, and yet there was no time for it to be reviewed or changed? Would due process, would fairness, would something not require an ability to review it?
I think there may be a due process claim there. But that's not here, nor have they claimed a due process argument in this case. They haven't raised any constitutional, Mr. Hatfield talked about it's unfair, but they have not raised any claim that the statutes or the application of the statutes, which on their face, in the plain language of the statutes, are clear. They must. It's a mandatory language.
Well, what about the concept that this type of claim could always have been brought in election contest? The legislature just provided an added remedy, pre-election. So you could have always done it after the fact. There's no case that says you couldn't as of yet. I see there's no case. So what's wrong with the assumption that you could have always brought this type of irregularity after the fact, but the legislature thought if what you really want is a fair election as opposed to an election contest, right, we'll give you a remedy where you can bring your claims ahead of time.
Well, that would give no meaning to the language in 116.19, and that is it must be done 10 days after the certification. Moreover, I think actually I got the case last night that they cited, and that is the Beatty case. And in that case, I think it's instructive on this point, actually. And there was previously authorization to do post-election or election challenges afterwards to, and this was not a summary statement case. And in that, this court said the only remedy now is because of the legislature injected itself and made that limitation, the only way that they could have a cognizable claim is through the election statutes. And so I think it cuts that off, actually. So not only does it render the language in Section 116.190 superfluous, but it also creates a tremendous...
But they purport they are using the election statute. So the question is if it applies to them. They're not suggesting...
Right.
They could do it otherwise.
Right. No, I'm not suggesting they're seeking a writ or a declaratory judgment, which this cuts it off.
I understand your point, but I think their point is that if historically election contest, the concept was encompassed ballot language, then unless something says it does not, why would that change?
But it has never historically encompassed ballot summary language. That is always, from the very moment it was included as a right to both have a summary statement in a ballot title, it included a remedy and a limitation on that remedy. And if this were a case in which they had an hour or less than an hour, you know, or they moved, the legislature moved it back 2 weeks so that there was absolutely no opportunity to challenge it pre-election, which is contemplated, then I think we'd have a different situation. We might have a due process claim.
Was Beatty an election contest, or was it a ballot issue, or was it a person on the ballot?
It was a local ordinance that put language on the ballot for a bond.
Okay.
And it wasn't a summary of it. It was just the we want this question on the ballot. So
I know you're keeping track of your time.
Yes, I'm about to run out. So the second issue, I do want to speak to the issue of whether or not it's fair and sufficient. This court, I acknowledge this court said in Dotson that there could be a post-election challenge. I don't know what that means. And it produces what we see in the second case, and that is you can not challenge it at all and wait. There they had plenty of time to challenge it, and they didn't challenge it and wait until after the post-election to challenge it. Now, on whether or not it meets the standards for a summary statement, I don't know if fair and sufficient. Chapter 115 says nothing about fair and sufficient as the standard. And I would suggest, because that is the standard that is specifically included in Chapter 116, by virtue of statutory construction and the canons of construction, we cannot infer that into an election irregularity. Certainly the legislature knew how to express whether something is a challenge as fair and sufficient, and could have done that in Chapter 115, but they did not. And they did not do that repeatedly, decade after decade after when they changed it, including in the 1970s when they made a major revision. They maintained that difference. The things that they have identified as that they feel are unfair or insufficient are not unfair or insufficient, and certainly that has been heavily briefed. I want to just highlight a couple of things.
But your argument is if it's not unfair and insufficient, what is the standard?
Yeah, I don't know what the standard is.
But what is the standard for other election contests?
An election irregularity that is of sufficient magnitude that it constitutes, that it casts doubt on the election. So, and the other thing I would say is that Chapter 115 talks about evidence and proving these sort of things, and the only thing we have here is the summary statement, which is provided for and limited and a remedy in Chapter 116. On the I think probably the one that is worth talking, the two that are worth talking about is the strict scrutiny versus an alienable right. I would say, first I would say, of course, the fair ballot language was available to all the voters in the polling place. It was as was the actual language of the provision. And I would say, even in the fair ballot language, the Secretary of State did not include a recitation of strict scrutiny as a new provision. So, and I guess I would say also, this court has now heard at least a couple of cases arguing about what that new amendment means. So the uncertainty of whether what that really means is still in question. And so for the legislature to try to define to the courts or to the in their summary statement what that means is not necessary. What was necessary is to put voters on notice of what the purpose of the amendment was, which was to elevate or heighten the protections for the right to keep and bear arms, which they effectively did by saying it is a declaration that the right to keep and bear arms is unalienable. And then similarly, the removal of the concealed weapons before this provision was in place and after this provision. Missourians had the right to concealed weapons. So to say something about that, I think, would only further create confusion.
Well, the question that's raised by Mr. Hatfield is whether the Constitution now mandates the right to carry concealed weapons versus allowed previously. But that's a significant change.
It may be, if that's the way it's interpreted. That's the question. We don't know how it will be interpreted. It's uncertain as to what it means. I would have read the original Constitution to suggest, a very restrictive, if not eliminated, right to carry concealed weapons. But in fact, the legislature and this court has said, no, there's still a right to concealed weapons, and there still is today. So in terms of communicating the purpose, it doesn't change that fundamentally for the voters. And my time is up. I need to turn my time over. Thank you.
May it please the court.
May proceed.
I want to talk about two issues, the first being jurisdiction. And here the General Assembly agrees with the plaintiffs that the Constitution, Article 7, Section 5, grants the General Assembly the authority to give jurisdiction to particular courts. But I understand what my colleague in the Attorney General's office is saying. This is not necessarily an appropriate grant. If it is not, we do not believe it can be severed from the rest of the election contest. We have seen in this case, they have filed in Cole County. In the next case, they filed in Benton County. If the General Assembly cannot grant jurisdiction to this court, as it did, then it did not grant jurisdiction to any particular court. Therefore, it could be in any court or multiple courts in the state, and that would create confusion. I don't think the General Assembly would have done that. And the statute that says you can generally sever a provision also says that you cannot sever provisions that are integrally tied. The second issue I wanted to address was that this amendment became law, became part of the Constitution 30 days after the election. The election was on the 4th of August, so September 4th, this would have become part of the Constitution. Article 12, Section 2B provides, if a majority of the votes cast thereon is in favor of any amendment, the same shall take effect the end of 30 days after the election. I think that provides us with the reason for saying it's in effect now. The Tompkins case says that you cannot go back and repeal the people in a referendum cannot go back after it takes effect. I think this is true here. I'm going to give the rest of my time to the senator.
Thank you. May it please the court.
Proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. So we're all back from where we were before, and we certainly got into the weight of the fairness and the sufficiency of the summary when we were here before, but this is a different issue now, because that was speculation on whether or not some voter was potentially going to be misled by what they claimed was a false or unfair summary, but we're past that now. And I mean, I believe with the Attorney General's office that under 115.553, this is not an irregularity of an election contest. And I think, and we've all briefed the cases because the courts look at that issue on what it is and what it isn't. But even if it is in the alternative, the plaintiffs still have the burden to put on some evidence of an irregularity, if that's what we're going to call it, or that somebody was misled. They had that opportunity. A special master was appointed. There is no evidence in this record. Even the plaintiffs don't admit that they were misled and somehow voted otherwise.
Why isn't the language itself evidence?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Why isn't the language itself evidence?
Because it can't be. By nature, they have to prove it. If we're going to call it an irregularity, they have to prove an irregularity. The burden is on them to show evidence of that. I don't think the court now can look at how Missourians voted and overwhelmingly voted to strengthen the right to keep and bear arms and then say, well, we think maybe somebody was misled, when clearly the plaintiffs had the opportunity. The whole purpose of this court establishing a special master was for that opportunity. And there is zero evidence for this court to look at to say that anyone was misled, much less plaintiffs don't even allege they were misled. So again, I don't think you get past the first hurdle that the Attorney General's office raised, which is this does not fit within the statutory definition of their claim. But I think even if you were to get beyond that, they still have the burden of proof to put something in the record. This record is absolutely devoid of anything in that regard. And I think if you're going to make it past the first hurdle, it's impossible to get past the second hurdle.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court. First on the statutes, I don't know if it was an epiphany, but as Mr. Morgan was talking, it occurred to me that there's another way to think about these statutes that's important. If a citizen came in and wanted to challenge a summary statement pre-election before the Secretary of State, when the Secretary of State had written it, they would have no standing. They would have no injury. They would simply be some citizen who disagrees with something that the Secretary of State has done. And so the pre-election challenge statutes give standing to any citizen to come in at any time and challenge something that hasn't happened yet, which is a fairly unusual concept in our jurisprudence. So they can come in and say, I would like a determination about this summary statement that will be on the ballot later and has not been voted on. And there is no real effect of it yet, except the voters are going to see it. And so the statutes on pre-election challenge, I think when we were talking about whether you have declaratory judgment authority or equity authority, I think those statutes do something important, which is give the opportunity for pre-election review that I have trouble understanding how that would exist under our normal concepts of standing and injury. Now, post-election, you still have a standing analysis issue. Can any citizen come in and challenge an election? And the legislature has given standing, specifically in the statute, to any citizen to challenge. Now, if it wasn't there, my job would be much harder, and I might be able to figure out a way.
Wouldn't you have to prove that you were misled by the language?
I think you would.
Don't you have to prove that
probably
now?
It's interesting that we say that because, you know, I feel like we're just spinning around in circles in this case. When we do pre-election challenges, I've asked to put on evidence that people are going to be misleading. The state says, no way, you can't do that.
But the state points out, or opposing counsel points out, that Chapter 115 talks about evidence, talks about irregularities, talks about a master.
Sure.
It's geared towards providing evidence, which the pre-election challenge is not. And assuming for the moment you're right that you can challenge it at either time, doesn't it have a different avenue in the pre-election time? It's a legal challenge. But afterwards, you have to have evidence of irregularities. What was your evidence?
Well, the evidence is in the record. I mean, the special master made findings of evidence. he admitted into, or suggested, I'm not sure how that works exactly, suggested to this court that you adopt his report admitting into evidence the actual language. The jurisprudence on this issue has so far been fairly consistent that the only evidence the court needs to determine if a ballot summary is unfair or insufficient is the ballot summary, which is in evidence and was taken into evidence, stipulated into evidence, and the underlying proposal, which is in evidence and was taken into evidence. So I agree with you.
The finding of irregularity is a legal question, not a fact question.
It is a, well, it's a mixed question of law and fact. Of course, you have to have something in the record. I'm suggesting that the only evidence you need is the summary and the language. And we talked at length about the Florida case, which discusses this, where the Florida Supreme Court said, what do you mean evidence? If the language was deceptive, then we have a fundamental problem. We don't know that anyone had in front of them the proper information they needed to make a vote.
Mr. Hatfield, what is the remedy that you're asking us to award?
Yeah, remedy is a tricky one, I must admit. The statutes talk about the ability to set aside the election, and the legislature has given the courts the ability to call for a new election. I think where we run into so I think that's easy. I think if the court believes that the summary statement is insufficient and unfair, rises to the sufficient magnitude, then the court may order a new election, may send out, there's another statute that talks about notice to the clerks to correct their records on whether this election was, whether this proposal properly won the election, for want of a better term. The statute goes on to talk about setting of a new election date. And the statute is written in permissive terms, may do these things. The problem we have is that the Constitution discusses the setting of election dates. And so the remedy we've asked is that you do what the statute allows you to do and set aside the election. We didn't specifically say this in the brief, but I guess you could order a new election. It's just that I think you're going to run into a constitutional problem with setting the date. And going to concepts of fairness, it's fair that the legislature be allowed to set it because they're going to want to write a different summary. So we're
and
sort
you're
of
not asking us to say what would be a fair and sufficient summary.
That's correct.
As would be the remedy in the pre-election challenge.
As would be the remedy in a pre-election challenge. That is correct.
Your opponent said that there needed to be some evidence of a voter being misled. Did you provide any evidence, or did the commissioner find any evidence in this area?
We called no voters to testify that they had been misled.
So you feel that's not necessary?
That's correct.
Right. Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.